All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. We just got some Supreme Court is out of session. Honorable Justice Jill Karofsky is presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Good morning, everybody. Please have a seat. Before we get started today, I just have two preliminary things. The first is I understand we have a special guest with us today. You're all special, but we have an extra special guest, Justice Hagedorn's wife, Margaret, is with us. So welcome. We're glad you're here today. And oh, thank you. We look forward to a full critique of our colleague afterwards. We actually have a second extra special guest. Justice Bradley has just informed me that her brother Jim is also here today. So we welcome you as well. One more thing. It is customary for us on the Wisconsin Supreme Court to recognize a justice's service to the court and the state at his or her last oral argument. That no is not going to work. As today's Justice Rebecca Bradley's last oral argument, I want to take a moment to thank her for her service and to share some highlights from her almost 11 years on the court. Sit tight, it'll be over soon. Justice Bradley was appointed to the court in 2015 and she won election in 2016. She is the first justice to sit on this court who also served as a circuit court judge and a judge on the Court of Appeals before serving on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. During her time here, she participated in almost 500 oral arguments. Yeah. And if my math is correct, she authored 61 majority opinions, 68 concurrences, and 59 dissents. A few more on the way. In her writings, she relied heavily on a couple of authorities. For example, she cited the Federalist Papers 25 times. And she cited a book authored by Brian Gardner and Justice Antonin Scalia called Reading Law, The Interpretation of Legal Texts, 59 times. I thought it might be higher. One of those 59 times was in response to an opinion I wrote in 2021 called Strody versus Society Insurance. In her dissent, Justice Bradley quoted Garner and Scalia, quote, "Courts have sometimes ignored plain meaning in astonishing ways." She then wrote, "The majority opinion in this case presents yet another example." In her writing, she also demonstrated an affinity for referencing the classics. She cited Lewis Carroll twice. Other references included Shakespeare, Aristotle, Shelley, Milton, and C.S. Lewis. You are very learned. Justice Bradley didn't stop there, though. She also relied on pop culture to make her point. In response to another majority opinion that I authored last year in Brown versus the Wisconsin Election Commission, she referenced a line from the movie Gettysburg. Quote, "Well, I gotta hand it to you, George. You sure got a talent for trivializing the momentous and complicating the obvious. You ever consider running for Congress?" End of quote. In that same writing, she also referenced the Peanuts characters of Charlie Brown and Lucy. Quote, "The majority's failure to follow inconvenient precedent leaves litigants in the painful position of Charlie Brown, naively relying on Lucy's insincere promise to hold the football steady for his kick, only to find himself flat on his back after Lucy pulls the ball away." Justice Bradley is a huge Peanuts fan, by the way. She is also a huge fan of Bruce Springsteen, having attended several. What's the number?
I lost count after 60.
After losing count after 60 concerts. And she managed to work one of his lyrics from Badlands into her dissent to the 2025 Evers versus Markland case, which I might add was also in response to my majority opinion. The lyric, quote, "And the king ain't satisfied until he rules everything," end of quote. Justice Bradley, I want to personally thank you for artfully showing me the error of my ways. In all seriousness, you made me a better justice. You have been prepared every single time you walked into this hearing room, and I never wanted to be less prepared than you were, which was no easy task. You pushed me to really analyze and defend my positions. You challenged me to think harder and to look closer. And largely because of you, I realized how important it is in this job to remain curious. I learned that I do not have to always agree with you, but I owe it to you and I owe it to the people of this state to fully understand your position in each and every case. So in concluding, I feel compelled to draw upon not one, but two musical references from your opinions. The first from Sanders versus State of Wisconsin Claims Board, where you cited orchestral maneuvers in the dark. The lyric is, "If you leave, don't look back." And finally, from your concurrence in Johnson versus the Wisconsin Election Commission from 2022, this is also known as Johnson 3, where you cited none other than Eminem. The clock's run out, time's up, over. Wow. Among other things, you're a very good sport. Okay, down to business.
Except when we're playing tennis.
Right. The first case we have this morning is Charlie May Brecky versus Midwest Medical Insurance Company. May I please have the appearances? Good morning. Welcome. Welcome. Good morning to both of you. I have 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, followed by a 5-minute rebuttal. As has been our practice all term, if we are running over the time limits, but my colleagues or I still have questions that we want to ask, I'm going to permit everyone to get the answers to all of their questions, because I think it's important. So we'll use the lights to guide us, but we may go over, and I'll try to give both sides, you know, equal time, but certainly everyone's questions will be answered, and you'll have an opportunity to answer all the questions from my colleagues and from me. So with that, let's get started, please.
May it please the court. This case is before the court on certification by the Court of Appeals. The issue presented is whether an unborn child or any minor child is a patient under Wisconsin statute section 448.30 and thus entitled to informed consent with the independent right to pursue legal action against a physician who fails to comply with said statute. In this case, in the circuit court, the defendant moved for summary judgment, asserting that the defendant did not owe a duty of informed consent to Charlie May Brecky. The duty in the circuit court ruling was to the birth mother, who is a surrogate. And the circuit court also ruled that only the birth mother could pursue a civil action on behalf of Charlie May Brecky, because she was not a party to the litigation, that the case was dismissed. It was from that dismissal that there was an appeal, and it went to the Court of Appeals, and that was the certification question that they posed. Section 448, section 0.30 provides any physician who treats a patient shall inform the patient about the availability of reasonable alternate medical modes of treatment and about the benefits and risks of these treatments. The statute also, as of 2013, added a reasonable physician standard as to what needs to be disclosed. The reasonable physician standard was never addressed in a summary judgment action at all. The defendants asserted that there was no duty owed to Charlie Mae Brekke. The circuit court agreed. In this case, the birth mother testified that Dr. Battley never discussed a cesarean delivery with her or the risk of shoulder dystocia or what that meant. In this case, Dr. Battley was the delivering physician and he ordered continuous fetal heart monitoring during the labor up until the time of the delivery. So clearly he was providing treatment to Charlie Mae Brekke. Dr. Battley testified, and this was part of the summary judgment materials, that after the delivery, he spoke to the birth mother and wanted to know if his gestalt that she would not have wanted a cesarean delivery was correct. And Dr. Battley testified that the birth mother at that time said she would have preferred a cesarean section unless the baby weighed 13 or 14 pounds. Here, Charlie Mae Brekke weighed 11 pounds, 5 ounces. The birth mother, on the other hand, testified that conversation never took place, not before the delivery, not after the delivery. At trial, the defense experts all testified that the reason that this baby was injured was the size, her size, over 11 pounds, going through a normal size pelvis.
Counsel,
yes.
I get that you're going through the facts, but aren't we here on essentially denial of a partial motion for summary judgment, which means that your argument at that point was that there was a dispute, that there were facts in dispute, and that it shouldn't be dismissed. So
I've gone a little bit beyond. I'm sorry.
Well, no, that's fine. But does any of that matter? Are you asking us for remand so that the claim is recognized and you can proceed on the claim? Is that what you're asking us, right? Not to determine whether or not there was informed consent, whether or not the duty was.
You're absolutely correct.
Okay.
What I'm asking the court to do.
Pull your microphone up. I want to make sure everyone can hear you.
Hold not to touch it.
Oh, it's okay. I got you.
Maybe you could
move the podium up.
Raise the podium.
Is that okay? Oh, raise the podium?
A little bit.
Maybe a little bit.
You're kind of fading in and out.
There you go. And then use your inside scream, as I would say to my children.
Thank you.
So what are you asking us? What do you want from us?
what I'm asking is that the court remand this case to the circuit court for trial on the issue of informed consent. Now, when a mother is about to give birth, the physician actually has two patients, the mother and the baby about to be born. That's under the Preston versus Meritor case. That was an EMTALA case, but what the court held in that case is clearly a mother about to give birth, two patients, baby and mom.
At what point does that baby, does a fetus become a patient?
I would submit that once the baby is viable and about to be delivered, which was the case here, this injury occurred at the time of delivery. This was an induced delivery. The doctor was performing continuous electronic fetal monitoring. This is very different from the earlier abortion case where the mom had consented to an abortion. The baby was not viable, and the court held that the baby could not later sue. It was an unsuccessful abortion, could not later sue for injuries because for assault and battery, because the mom had consented and she had a right to consent.
There is a lot of time between viability and about to be delivered.
Yes.
Many months.
So I'm not sure at what point, but I am very confident that when we're talking about the day of delivery, and this baby is viable and undergoing continuous electronic fetal monitoring, this is a very different situation from the earlier abortion case.
But counsel, as I understand the claim as pled, what you're saying is that the birth mom here, Samantha, was not properly informed of the risks to the unborn baby at the time she made that choice to pursue a vaginal birth and right. not a planned cesarean section, which that's not when she's showing up at the hospital. Presumably that's at some point earlier that discussion was supposed to have happened, right?
Interesting thing is that discussion never took place.
Well, I understand that you're saying it never took place, but it would have happened under your theory at some point before. She's not spontaneously going into labor and showing up at the hospital. That's it's an emergency situation, right? Where in some cases there's an emergency need for a C-section. This isn't the claim. The claim is that there was a plan to induce and have her pursue vaginal birth as opposed to a plan to have her pursue a planned C-section.
So
right?
Presumably that would occur around the time of the last prenatal
visit. Some prenatal visit. Okay.
And also upon arrival at the hospital for the delivery.
She would have to be informed separately at both occasions. Is that what you're saying?
You'd have to be informed at least one of those occasions, and the last opportunity would have been on admission for the delivery of this baby.
So is it also part of your claim, though, that she wasn't informed when things started not going as well, that would have been a time? I'm just following up on this time frame of when you believe this now born baby became a patient. Is there also informed consent obligation once in your mind, once the baby is not coming out very easily, that at that point she should have been informed of the right to have a C-section, or that she should have a C-section?
Absolutely, Your Honor. At any point in time, either pre-labor or during labor, if the circumstances change to the point where continuing with a vaginal delivery, and another informed consent discussion should have taken place.
Well, counsel, as I understand the facts here, the injury occurred as the baby is emerging from the birth canal and gets stuck. And at that point, isn't it too late to do a C-section? Like, how could the doctor, you know, have worded
off? So that is not exactly what the defense theory was during the trial of this case. The evidence that was presented from all three medical experts was this did not happen after the head emerged from the vagina. This injury happened as the baby was traversing the birth canal, just too big a baby and too small a pelvis. So ordinarily, often, what happens with this type of injury, it's after the head delivers and the doctor applies excess lateral traction to the head, rupturing the nerves. But the defense in this case was steadfast. This happened way before the head ever delivered, way before Dr. Badley ever had his hands on the...
And again, this is a factual question, but the doctors would have known that was occurring.
I'm sorry.
The doctor would have known that was occurring and there would have been time to say we need to do an emergency C-section.
So at any time before the head delivered, that opportunity would exist. Now, there are some extraordinary measures that can be used even after the head delivers. It's called Zavanelli, pushing the head back up the vagina and doing a C-section. But looking at what happened here, accepting the defense expert's explanation is true. It happened before the head ever delivered.
Counsel, I think you just mentioned the Preston case. Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
I think you just mentioned the Preston case when you were talking about the case law. And I know that you have been relying primarily on case law for your argument that Charlie was a patient of Dr. Batley under the statute. But the cases that you relied on in your brief, I need you a little help with. Pierce and Preston were not informed consent cases, right?
That's correct.
So tell me how we rely on them and why.
Because what Preston establishes is that when a mom goes to a hospital about to deliver, there are two patients, the mom and the unborn baby. That is the purpose for which we cited the Preston case. But it is not an informed consent case.
Okay,
but it does establish that there are two patients at that stage.
Counsel, were you done, Justice Perseus?
I am. Go ahead.
Counsel, I'm wondering, you know, sometimes this court needs to do some line drawing. And I know you talked about viability and you know, because that came up in a prior case dealing with abortion. And I understand that perhaps is a bit of a unique context. I'm wondering if we need to get into any of that line drawing here regarding when somebody becomes a patient or is not a patient. And I guess I'm just want to throw out the question to you. Are you arguing, for example, that if a mother comes in who's 3 months along, that the doctor owes no duty of informed consent when providing care to the baby that she's carrying at that point in time? And it seems that if you're drawing a line at viability, you would, you know, we'd be almost saying that. And I'm wondering whether we need to, given the context of the facts of this case.
I submit we do not. That is not the situation we have here.
Right.
So I don't think we need to draw that line of at what point does it attach. But clearly, by the time this baby is about to be delivered, there should have been an informed consent discussion.
I want to go back to Justice Crawford's question and the point that you just made, because I'm still not seeing it clearly. Certainly, prior at a prior visit, before they came to the hospital for the delivery, they knew about the size of the baby, right? They had some inkling that this was a baby that was going to be on the large size.
Not entirely, because he hadn't done another ultrasound since, I think, 20 weeks.
So they were shocked to know how big the baby was until.
Well, that was the testimony, but she'd had big babies before. This happened to be bigger, and there was no effort to determine through ultrasound what the size was before this delivery. Now, that was not part of the trial because we were not allowed to go there.
But as I understand your argument, that as soon as the baby got stuck, that's when there should have been an informed consent conversation in this case?
So it was known it was going to be a big baby. What I submit is there should at least be a discussion. What would be material to the risks to the mom and what would be material risk to the baby.
So I really want
to focus in on that point. I had an emergency C-section. There is no time.
Right.
So I guess what I'm not understanding is your argument is that the fetus becomes a patient at the time of viability. There's a lot of time between viability and when a birth would happen. But you're saying all of that is not really consequential here. The only thing that's consequential is that moment in time, in this case, where that baby got stuck. And at that point, they were supposed to have the informed consent conversation.
No, I think it's before that, Your Honor. What I submit is when this mom arrived for the delivery of her baby, there should have been an informed consent discussion of the risks and benefits, cesarean versus vaginal, the risk to the mom, the risk to the baby. And that discussion just never took place.
Counsel, though, going back to the line drawing discussion, for this case, it doesn't really matter, right? Because the testimony, as I read the record, is unequivocal. The conversation never happened.
Right.
It didn't happen at any point in time that the surrogate was seeking Dr. Battley's care for the baby, for her. It didn't occur at any point in time, including the day of delivery or at the moment of birth. It just never happened. So for purposes of this case, the court does not need to draw those lines, correct? Because as I understand your argument, and I think there's an attempt to hem you into, really, you're saying that at the time this woman is delivering the baby, the doctor should have been having an informed consent discussion. I don't hear that to be your argument. I didn't read that to be your argument. And as I read the record again, Dr. Battley's testimony was, there's some back and forth, but basically the question posed to him during his deposition was, at any time prior to delivery, was the option of cesarean section discussed with this patient? The answer was no. He said, well, he didn't need to discuss the risks of gestational diabetes and macrosomic births because she had already had babies under those circumstances. He also said it was his general practice to discuss those risks, but with respect to this patient and this baby, he pretty much affirmed that he did not have that conversation. So again, for this case, for the purpose of answering the certified question, we do not need to draw those lines or decide when a baby becomes a patient or at what time it's appropriate to have the conversation with the surrogate or the birth mother.
That is correct. That is not my argument.
Yeah, and that's the way I read it as well, counsel. And so to me, when I read everything and I read the record, to me, this was a pretty easy fix. At a point when Dr. Battley, who has delivered other children with the surrogate, tell me if I'm wrong, I think it was a pretty easy fix in regard to him explaining to the mother the risks associated with a vaginal versus a C-section for her. And I think it would have been pretty easy in my mind for him to go on and say, you've delivered larger children in the past, and let's talk about some of the other potential risks. That's the way I looked at it, and I didn't think it would have been that challenging to have remedied the problem here. Am I right or wrong?
I submit you're right. Had the discussion taken place, had he fully informed the mom for the benefit of Charlie Mae Brekke, of what the risks were to Charlie Mae Brekke, regardless of what the birth mom ultimately decided to do, there would be no liability on the part of Dr. Battley.
Yeah, that's the way I read it.
And just to be clear, Charlie would have no informed consent claim had that conversation occurred, regardless of the choice that the surrogate made with respect to vaginal versus cesarean delivery.
That is correct. You know, once the doctor fulfills his obligations under informed consent, so I just imagining a jury verdict. Did the doctor fulfill his obligations under informed consent? If the answer is yes, you don't go on to question number two, causation. It's just the end of the case.
Yeah. So I'm not trying to, was it hem you in?
Yes.
I'm going to add that to my list. I actually wasn't trying to do that. I was thinking about, you know, our cases, we don't decide the cases in vacuums, right? Like just like Pierce and Preston are being cited to today, this case could very well be cited to in the future, and it's going to be used to inform doctors. We had the amicus brief filed by the American Medical Association. This is going to be used by courts and by medical professionals going forward. And so I'm trying to think in my head about what we would write in our opinion in order to make sure that the facts are as you say, which I think at the beginning you said, this was a baby that was about to be delivered. I mean, is
right.
That the limiting factor here? Suggest that we write it.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of what you said.
Is that how you suggest we write it? If we're going to make sure that we are addressing a narrow set of circumstances, because this case is going to be used by others. It's not, you know, your case is real important before us, but this, you know, we'll set precedent going forward. And my question to you is, what would that narrow ruling look like from us?
I wish I were smart enough to know. it's not the case that I'm presenting, but certainly by the Certainly when the mom arrives at the hospital to deliver the baby, that discussion had to take place.
Well, let me jump in. I don't want to answer your question, but I need to understand your position too, because I think you're going a little more narrow than the case or informed consent law warrants here. For purposes of this case and for future cases, if a mother is intending to have the baby, to deliver the baby, at that point in time that the mother makes the decision that she wishes to continue this pregnancy and deliver a baby, then the doctor is providing care for two patients, as cases have alluded to for many years. So the doctor is not just providing care to the mother, the doctor is providing care to the baby when the mother decides to have that baby. And that could occur much earlier on in the pregnancy than the exact moment of birth. So I think it's at that point in time, at a minimum, is it not?
I would submit you're correct. If we look at the point where the decision is made, are we going to proceed with a vaginal delivery in this delivery? There really has to be that informed consent discussion. It just never happened.
Okay, but I just want to make sure that you're answering Justice Bradley's question. If Justice Bradley's question is, at the moment that you know you are pregnant and you decide to go ahead with that pregnancy, that can be way before viability. That can be weeks, right? That can be weeks after conception.
Absolutely.
Okay, is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is for the purposes of this case, at some point in time, when a decision is made to proceed with a vaginal delivery, the patient really has to be told the pros and cons of that approach.
And this is an ongoing conversation with the mother, correct? Because earlier on, the baby could be below the weight that right. is the target range of weights for a healthy baby. And that can change. I mean, several months long. And so as risks become apparent, as there are changes to the mother's health or the baby's health, the unborn baby's health, then the doctor needs to have an ongoing conversation, correct? About the choices of care going forward.
Agreed. So I would submit that any time there is this discussion of a vaginal delivery, regardless of where it is along the course of the pregnancy, the doctor should have that discussion.
I have two questions, counsel. Is there any dispute here that when I talk, usually the room does light up like that? Is there any dispute that the mom in this fact scenario had the responsibility or authority to make the decision for what was best for both her and the child she was carrying?
There's no dispute about that.
And we probably don't need to go any sort of further into other fact scenarios. And this is a little bit of a unique situation, here, but everyone agrees based on the surrogacy contract that was true,
right?
At the very least, right? Okay, great. My second question is, and this partially comes from the certification and some of the questions that were there about 44830. It seems to me that if one agrees with the proposition that the unborn child in this fact scenario was a patient, that the exceptions here, as I read the statute, are not to whether somebody is a patient, but they're exceptions to they're exceptions that circumscribe the doctor's duty to patients in those
right. yes.
circumstances. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay.
So,
but I would submit that none of those exceptions apply here.
I don't know if that matters for purposes of your, maybe tell me if it does, but if your argument is this was a patient to whom some duty was owed in this scenario, it ran through the mother, just like any other minor, right? If it's a two-year-old, obviously the mom's, the two-year-olds don't understand complex information either,
right?
So that would run through the parents in that situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Could I just give you something to think about as you sit down and you come back for rebuttal, because I see that your red light is on, but if you want to answer it, you can. If it is true that the mother gets to make the decisions regarding decisions for herself and the baby, right? You said there's no dispute. That was in the agreement, right?
It was in the, yes, it was in the agreement.
Okay. So if the plaintiffs, not the baby, but if the plaintiffs gave up that right by contract, how can they come back after the fact and say they want to assert that they have the right they gave up?
So I don't think the surrogacy contract supersedes the right of the baby to an informed consent. I think the doctor still has to have that.
But that call goes to the mother, not the father.
I would agree. So the mom has to be fully informed of the risks and benefits, vaginal delivery, cesarean delivery, but she ultimately makes the call.
How is that not her claim then, instead of the plaintiff's? Here?
Because this is not a derivative claim. This is a direct injury to the baby. There are certain types of claims that are derivative claims, like a wrongful death claim. It's brought on behalf of the estate, but the takers have a derivative claim. A loss of consortium claim, that's a derivative claim because it's not a direct injury to the person making the claim. But this is a direct injury to Charlie Mae Brekke, and therefore she has a right to bring the claim, whether or not the surrogate mom is a party to the action.
And just to be clear, in this case, it is Charlie, the child, who is advancing the claim. Of course, she is a minor. So in other circumstances where a minor child has a claim, or a person who has been deemed incompetent has a claim, somebody who is the guardian, or in the case of a minor, the parent or guardian, advances that claim, but it's still the child or the incompetent person's claim, correct?
Exactly. And in this case, it was one of the dads that brought it on behalf of Charlie Mae Brekke. She was adopted by that time, so the surrogate really had no standing to bring the claim at that time, and it wasn't necessary. She was not an indispensable party.
And in fact, one of the fathers is not an adoptive father. He is, in fact, the biological father, correct?
So when your friends on the other side talk about this reasonable baby perspective, you're not arguing that anybody look at something through the lens of a reasonable baby?
So I think what was intended there is what we have to look at when there's an informed consent discussion. Was the mom advised as to all of the risks to her? Was she also advised as to the risks of the baby?
But it's not the reasonable baby we're looking at. We're looking at a reasonable person, in this case, the mom.
Yeah, making a decision on behalf of the baby, what's in the baby's best interest. Okay. That's what we intended by that.
Go ahead. Okay, thank you. So the defendant's position seems to be that the doctor owed its duty of informed consent to Samantha, the pregnant woman, right?
The birth mom.
Right,
yep.
The birth mom. And they, I believe, concede or agree that the doctor had an obligation in informing the woman as the patient of risks to the unborn child, but that duty ran to the mom to provide that information so that she could properly consent to the medical procedures contemplated, which was either proceeding with a vaginal birth or a cesarean section. So if, in fact, they are correct about that, that the duty runs to the laboring woman, do you have a claim that could be independently brought by Charlie for the injuries to Charlie that you're asserting came from the failure to inform the mother?
So the mother is actually acting in a representative capacity.
And that's not what I'm positing here. Okay. I'm positing that it is the woman who is the patient, and that the doctor did not properly inform her of the potential consequences of proceeding with a vaginal birth. Do you still, if we held that, would you still have a claim to assert on behalf of Charlie due to the injuries to Charlie.
I'm not entirely sure I'm understanding, but let me try answer. What I'm saying in this case is that the doctor had two patients and both had an independent right to pursue an action for informed consent if they were not given a proper informed consent. And here, the birth mom didn't have any injuries at all, and she did not pursue anything. But Charlie Mae Brecky was injured, mm-hmm. and she has a right to make a claim because it is an independent claim for her own injuries. This is not a derivative claim. It's not like a loss of consortium case. It's a direct injury.
Even though the duty to provide the information was to provide it to the birth mom, and the mom is the one has the decision to make about what the medical procedures are that she's subjecting herself to, including a cesarean section, which is cutting her body open,
right,
not the baby's.
Right.
That is what you're saying she didn't have the opportunity to consent to as a procedure in on her body. Right?
That's correct.
Once again, you're not asking us to second guess the surrogate in this case or the birth mother's decision to proceed with a vaginal delivery, even if it were against the best interests of the child, because it is the mother's right to, in this case, to make that decision. Even if it's adverse to the baby, you wouldn't have, Charlie would not have a claim.
Had she been fully informed of the risk to Charlie Mae Brecky, and made that decision, there would be no right of action here.
So the AMA, as I mentioned before, filed a brief in this case, and they say this, plaintiff asserts that she can bring a claim against the physician because she was entitled to give a different answer to informed consent than her mother. Can you respond to that?
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you.
Sure, so the AMA filed a
amicus
brief in this case. And in that brief, they say the following: plaintiff, you, assert that you can bring a claim against the physician because you were entitled to give a different answer to informed consent than her mother.
Not exactly true, because if the mom has been fully informed of the risks to the baby fitting with a vaginal delivery, and makes that decision with that full knowledge of that information, then the doctor has fulfilled his obligations.
Why is that not a duty that the doctor owes to the pregnant woman?
So the
or are you saying it's both? I'm just not understanding why it is that we even have to reach the question about some separate duty owed to the unborn child when we have a real live woman sitting here who has to decide whether how she wants to proceed with this birth. Doesn't the doctor have to tell her what the relevant risks are to both herself and the baby?
That's exactly true, but it's very clear here that we have two patients, Charlie Mae Brecky and the birth mom.
But it's the same conversation that has
it is
to happen.
Thing. It is the same conversation.
This is no different than if we're dealing with, say, a two-year-old child, right? The child has some medical issue. Decisions need to be made on behalf of the child because a two-year-old doctor can't have a conversation with the two-year-old about what the two-year-old would want, how to proceed with the treatment options. So that conversation is held with the parents, and the parents ultimately make the decision. So we need not get caught up in the fact that there's an unborn baby that a mother might be cut into because there is a possibility of a cesarean section, that's all the mother's call, right? The point is, and the very narrow holding that you're seeking, I think, from this court, is that the doctor was obligated to have that conversation with the mother. He didn't, and that's a breach of informed consent law.
That is our argument.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Knott.
May it please the court. Good morning, members of the panel. I should have acknowledged, members of the court, I should have acknowledged as well that that Dr. Battley is here in the courtroom as well when I introduce myself. I'm Doug Knott, speaking for the respondents. This appeal rests on a shifting theory that has changed and narrowed as each prior version of their argument has been cast aside as untenable. And I hear further narrowing even today. But the narrowing doesn't make the argument stronger. It just makes it harder to spot the flaw. So the problem with the Brekke's argument is that it continues to undermine the rights and the autonomy of pregnant women.
I've got a question for you, counsel. Do you think that if a pregnant woman comes in and is talking through her pregnancy, she's 3, 4, 5, 6 months along, there's no particular, do you think a doctor owes any duty to the unborn child in that situation for care that's being provided?
Yes.
And on what basis?
On the basis of the standard of care and negligence, the case law recognizes that a child can bring a claim for negligence for prenatal injury.
Do you think that negligence is the theory that under the common law, at least this court adopted, upon which our 44830 was adopted, codifying the common law in that situation? That's the basis for informed consent, is that sort of theory. And so if you agree that there could be negligence in care to an unborn child, what would make you argue that the statute that codifies that standard of care and the duty to inform from a doctor would not also make the unborn child a patient?
The statute is bottomed in negligence. And I think that allows for, once the liability is established, for the claim to proceed as if it were a finding of negligence. But it is a statutory duty. That was codified. The finding that the baby is a patient. We don't take the position that there were two patients, and that's because the legislature in 2013 responded to the Gendre decision by saying, we're going to interpret this case from the point of view of standards of care and professional standards. And when you look at the professional standards, and we cited the ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, when you look at their standards, they don't consider the baby as a second patient. They're in the ACOG committee ethics opinion. They say that the mother is the primary patient with a beneficent interest in protecting the child.
I'm just not understanding. Do you think that a doctor who, say, is concerned about the health of an unborn child at some point during the course of a woman's pregnancy has a duty to tell the mother about various risks associated with her pregnancy as it relates to the health of the unborn child? Is there an informed consent duty at all that applies to the health of the unborn child?
Sure. Yeah.
Where do you get? Where do you get that from,
Justice? I think I need a little more facts in terms of whether we're talking about a standard of care, as in the doctor needs to take this additional step, versus a conversation and a decision about future treatment.
Well, I mean, pick the facts that make it clear for you. I mean, a child that looks like an unborn child that looks like it might have some health complication somewhere along the way. Perhaps there's a treatment or conversation that might need to happen in order to preserve or help help the child in some way. I mean, you can pick whatever you want. It seems to me you're arguing that doctor owes a duty to the unborn child, but has no duty to provide any, to do any informed consent to the mother of who's carrying that child regarding the health of the unborn child. And I'm trying to figure out why you would draw that line or distinction.
Well, the duty runs to the mother. So the duty to the mother includes the duty to protect the child. So they can proceed on claims of negligence that might cause an injury to the baby. But under the statute as it exists in Wisconsin, the duty needs to run directly to the mother as the patient.
And does the unborn child's health matter at all to you?
Excuse me?
Does the unborn child's health matter at all in that duty to provide informed consent?
Well, of course, yes. There's ethical duties to do the best for the child.
I'm talking about statutory duties.
Well,
because that's the duty is codified in statute, right? This wasn't the common law. It's a negligence theory. The negligence theory is what underlies the whole informed consent thing. And that then gets codified in 1980s. That says you need to provide informed consent when you're providing care, 1982, I think. So I'm trying to understand, you believe that a doctor owes some duty to this unborn child, including duty to, but I'm not clear whether you think it has a duty to inform at all. You feel like you're not answering the question. Help me out.
I think that the issue is that the duty needs to run to the mother in order to protect against the really kind of insidious case where there is a conflict of interest between the baby and the child. And our position is that the duty does run to the mother. The baby could have brought a claim to enforce the mother's right of informed consent, but the baby does not have an independent claim to informed consent, because it has the potential then in a certain circumstance to cause a conflict of interest with the interest of the mother.
So is your logic that the mother would need to bring a claim in such situation, that the mother would need to bring the claim in this situation on behalf of the injuries for Charlie?
Our position is that the mother is the patient, and that the mother needs to be a party to the case, whether it's through the concept of derivative injury or whether it's through the concept of a necessary party, the mother needs to be a party to the case. And that's what the judge in the trial court ruled. He said, I hold that the duty is owed to the mother, and the claim has to be brought through the mother.
So you'd like us to hold that there is no duty from a doctor to an unborn child regarding informed consent at all, that applies at any time prior to birth, at some point during the birth process? Is that your position?
No.
So 4830 by patient only means born patients?
Yeah, and I'm sorry that I'm not making myself clear, but the duty, the child has the right to enforce the statute. The child has the right to bring a claim to enforce the mother's right to informed consent.
But how is that, when you're talking about derivative claims and necessary party claims, that doesn't follow from what you just said. You just made a statement, the child has a right to enforce the statute, and the child has its own injuries that are separate and apart from the mom's. And so I don't understand how, you're saying derivative or necessary party, why?
Well, because of the potential, we have to avoid the potential that there could be a second.
How could there be? And I heard you, and it made sense to me that the concern about that there could be a conflict between the baby and the mom, but you're never looking at the baby's choice here. This is informed consent. This is the baby saying mom needed to be informed. As long as mom is informed, mom can have a totally different view than you think a baby might have had. That's not going to matter. Was mom informed? And was baby harmed if mom wasn't? I mean, that's the claim, right?
It is the claim, but that's not the claim that the plaintiffs have been pursuing.
Why do you say that?
Because
that's not what I heard because they have argued.
Tell me what the claim is they're pursuing, because I don't understand that to be any different.
The plaintiff's argument is that the duty runs from to the baby.
That isn't the duty is a patient, right?
The duty is to the we don't think that the baby is a patient under the statute, because in order to make sense of the statute calls for informing the patient. You can't inform a fetus.
Okay, but so, wait, I'm gonna stop right there.
Put that aside.
Then you could never have informed consent of a minor child. You could never have a claim involving informed consent of a minor child, because a minor child cannot understand anything. They can't make a claim. So you, if that's how you want us to rule, we would take informed consent from minor.
You know, the circuit court in the certified question included minor child. I don't think that's really the right thing to do, because what we're talking is a situation where the decider, the guardian, is a patient herself. So, to get back to your question, there is a duty that runs to the mother. There's a duty that runs to the child. Their argument is that the duty runs, and it's an independent duty that they're seeking to enforce. Our position is that they can bring a claim to enforce the right of the mother. But if you allow them an independent claim, then you're allowing for a circumstance where there could be a conflict of interest.
How?
So, okay, for example, say that a physician is having a discussion with a mother who's ready to give birth. She has some risk factors where a C-section might be a reasonable recommendation. So the discussion's occurring. The doctor says, in cases of C-section, you should know there's a 6 to 7% chance of increased mortality for you going through a C-section, and that's actual. And the mother says, "Well, that's enough for me."
That's a conflict.
And I'm ready to go through a trial of labor. The plaintiffs in this case have been arguing until today that the decision is up to the reasonable baby.
Okay.
So that baby, or her guardian who brings the lawsuit, Mr. Tennyson, years later, up to 10 years later, says, you know what? There was an injury that occurred when she went through labor. I want to say that I want that argument that the conversation was not adequate. That 6 or 7%, that means nothing to me as the baby.
Okay. Let's take away the reasonable baby. We're not saying that.
As Justice Dallet is saying, because I think they've indicated that they're not pursuing it, at least the way we may have understood it, and it's not the issue that was certified to us. So I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's okay. How is there a conflict if it is the mother who decides? In your scenario, the conversation was had, end of story. Whether the mom decides to have that C-section or not, that baby does not have a claim for an informed consent violation. And maybe mom made a good decision and maybe mom didn't, and maybe we'll never know. And that's mom's choice. But that doesn't affect the claim. So I would like, do you have an example where there is going to be some kind of conflict? Because I'm just not seeing what you're saying.
So if that conversation occurs, and you have a rule that the baby can bring an independent claim for up to 10 years, then the doctor has to be considering what the fetus interest is, separate and distinct from mothers.
Why? You just started your sentence with the conversation occurred. As long as the conversation occurs, end of story, done. This claim is about informed consent. That's it.
Right. And
it's not about baby being able to bring some kind
of... If the conversation occurs and the patient makes the decision, the mother makes the decision, it needs to be binding. It needs to be... Yes.
So how is what they're arguing for not binding?
Because they're coming in and saying, we're allowed, even if the mother has chosen to have to go through labor, we're allowed to come in on behalf of the baby.
And say that the conversation never happened, right?
Correct.
What evidence in the record is there that any conversation did or did not happen, meaning informed consent discussion?
Well, as you pointed out, as Justice Dallet pointed out, there was not presentation of evidence at the trial court on summary judgment, but there was, there's a form in the record from the trial court, from our trial of this matter, where Dr. Badley had a conversation with her about a trial of labor, and she signed off on a form. It was in his office at the last clinic visit, and it includes the risk that if you go through, if you induce labor, there is a heightened chance of a C-section. But more to the point, when Mr. Tennyson said the conversation didn't occur, it did occur. This was a professional surrogate. She delivered, she'd gone into labor 6 times, delivered 7 babies. She delivered a 10-pound, 9-ounce baby 10 years ago. Women with that experience do not schedule a C-section. And that's, so Dr. Batley, and what I'm getting at here is that the court has said that this analysis needs to be fact-driven and context-specific.
Which means it goes to the jury. So we're not here to decide whether the conversation occurred or not. I want to reorient the argument to the certified question. And I agree with you, there were all kinds of other issues thrown into the mix before us, but the Court of Appeals certified a narrow question to us. It is whether an unborn child is a patient under the informed consent statute and entitled to informed consent with the independent right to pursue legal action against a physician who doesn't comply with the statute. So we're not going to delve into any of the record, the facts, what conversations were had or not. We simply have to answer that question. And as I am understanding your argument, you are arguing that an unborn child is not a patient under informed consent law. My question for you is, how do you square your argument with the multitude of statutes across the entire corpus of Wisconsin statutory law that recognizes an unborn child as a patient? And I'll point just one out to you. Chapter 48 protects unborn children, even if their mother carrying the child is trying to drink the child to death. The state can intervene and prevent the mother from killing her unborn child by using alcohol. So how do you square your argument that a child isn't a patient when Wisconsin law recognizes the right of the unborn to be protected from the mother choosing to consume amounts of alcohol that will harm or kill the fetus?
Really, two primary thoughts on that, Justice Bradley. One is that under basic tenets of statutory interpretation, we start with the plain language of the statute. Unfortunately, that doesn't supply much help for us. Then we go to the context and purpose of the statute, and there we have the answer. If the statute is intended so that there's a duty to inform the patients who are identified in that statute, then it cannot be a fetus.
I don't subscribe to the statutory interpretation approach that would look at what the legislature intended. I look at what the legislature wrote. So what in the statute can you point to that would exclude unborn children from the informed consent duty?
Well, in this circumstance, there's no duty to provide information that the patient is incapable of understanding.
So a 2-year-old does not have any rights under the informed consent law, under your argument?
I think that we would try to, again, try to, that the circumstance where there is a guardian for a minor and the guardian is not a patient, I think, is a different scenario.
So if there's a mother who's also a patient, then that completely erases the status of the unborn child as a patient? Is that your argument?
No, the baby is protected under standards of care, under the duties, the physician's obligation to be reasonable, to treat the baby with reasonable care, but the obligation is to the mother, and by except in these very narrow circumstances, the obligation is met by his performing by his relationship with the mother.
But I'm trying to understand why that is the case, because I am still understanding your argument to mean that minor children and adults who have been deemed incompetent to make their own medical decisions, who have had an HCPOA activated, then the doctor has no duty to obtain informed consent from that patient or that patient's guardian on behalf of the patient who has some incompetency that prevents the patient from understanding
not at
choices.
All. Under I'm sorry, not at all. The patient in that circumstance has a right to bring a claim. It just has to be brought with the guardian. So it has to be the guardian's decision that governs. And you can't have an independent test for whether the reasonable ward would have chosen differently.
But we're not looking at that. As I'm reading the bench and hearing the bench, we're narrowing in on what that certified question is, and it goes to whether there is an independent duty of informed consent under the informed consent law to both the patients, the unborn child and the mother. And there's a lot of dystopian, I think dystopia was a word, in fact, used in somebody's briefing about overriding the choices of the mother in this particular circumstance where she's making decisions on behalf of her unborn child or in her unborn child's interests. But the plaintiff has conceded already that that is not what they're asking for, that if the conversation happens, even if the mother makes a decision that leans toward her best interests that may be adverse to the health of the baby, there would be no claim under informed consent on behalf of the child.
I don't think so. I don't think that's correct. So if you look at, if we could use the hypothetical I used before, how does the physician discharge that duty to the baby? If there's an independent duty to the baby, and we're going to go to a jury trial where we're going to have an analysis of whether the doctor provided adequate information, under the plaintiff's characterization, that would be the decision of the baby. But what I hear from the court is that the mother's decision is dispositive. So what they're arguing is an independent right to come back without the mother to challenge whether the mother's decision was adequate.
That's not what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing is that now we have a child who I believe is 11 years old, somewhere in that vicinity. The child is advancing a claim that the doctor did not obtain the mother's informed consent, which means that the doctor did not advise the mother of the risks to herself and or the baby with proceeding with a vaginal delivery, given the size of the baby or the size the baby was likely to be. That's what I'm understanding, and perhaps it's been narrowed here at oral argument, but that's what I'm understanding the claim to be. Now, she was a surrogate. She had a donor egg fertilized by the biological father implanted in her, and pursuant to the surrogacy agreement and perhaps other factors, she is not the child's mother. The child has a biological father and an adoptive father. And at this point in time, the fathers are acting as fathers and having their child bring this claim as she is a minor child. So there's nothing about overriding the mother's decision or second guessing the mother's decision, as I understand the claim, as it may have been narrowed today at oral argument. It is that the conversation was not had. And so the case should go to the jury
to decide the factual disputes that remain. The jury never heard the informed consent claim, right? That was dismissed. So all they heard was the negligence claim. That's all they decided.
It's not been the argument that's been made. You know, and I apologize for bringing this up again, but at some point we have to give some respect to the trial court. And the argument that was made in the trial court was that the fathers have a duty of, are owed a duty of informed consent. But what's here today and what they're now arguing is that the baby has a right to independently challenge. And but on the basis of the conversation with the mother, if the mother is a party to that case, if her decision is dispositive, then we're okay with that.
Well, counsel, I have a question about that, because as I understand what you're saying, and I'm turning back to the language of the statute here, it says a physician who treats a patient shall inform the patient about alternative modes of treatment and about the benefits and risks of these treatments. And your position is, in informing a pregnant woman about the benefits and risks of the treatment, those include benefits and risks to the unborn child as well as to the woman. That's part of what a reasonable physician has to inform the woman as the patient, correct?
Sure.
And yeah. You also seem to concede that under circumstances like this, if there is a failure of informed consent and it results in an injury to the child, damages to the child, that the child does have a claim to recover damages. But you're saying that the mother has to be, or the pregnant woman, has to be a named plaintiff in that lawsuit because her statutory rights to informed consent were the rights that were violated. So I don't understand that last point. If the claim is damages only to the child and not to the pregnant woman, why does the woman have to be named as a plaintiff? Why can the child not assert the claim of that statutory violation that was a lack of information to the mother that resulted in harm to the baby?
Because the right of the mother is a very intimate right. It's her right to make a decision about whether she's going to go through surgery or deliver.
But she's not claiming damages. She's not claiming injury.
But it's that right that's injured. And that makes the baby's injury derivative of the mother's right.
And I understand it's derivative, but I still don't understand why the mother has to be named as a plaintiff if she is not seeking to recover damages for any for the statutory violation. The claim is that the injuries happen to the child.
And
putting aside a surrogacy case, if this was just a more typical case in which a woman was pregnant, was intending to raise the child, and the child was injured in birth, and she's saying, "Doctor, you didn't inform me of the possible risks to my baby. My baby was injured." Why does the mother have to be named as a plaintiff in that context? Why can't it just be the child who was injured and is claiming damages?
Because, well, the concern is that is evidenced in this case, because we don't agree with the plaintiffs that this conversation didn't occur. What the patient testified.
No, I understand that there's a factual dispute.
Yeah.
I'm just
and we don't want to
putting that aside for a moment. Why is it that the mother or the pregnant woman has to be named as a plaintiff if the claim is injuries to the child derived from a lack of informed consent to the pregnant woman?
Well, it's because it's the mother's right that's injured, because it's a derivative right, because also she's a necessary party. And what the
and is there case law or something saying that when it's a derivative right, the person with who was subject to that legal violation has to be a named plaintiff in that case? Because I'm thinking about things like, you know, there are cases of infliction of emotional distress where a bystander, somebody who was present and the scene of a traumatic, horrible incident, claims that they were injured as a result of things happening to other people. I don't think that the subjects of those primary injuries have to be named as plaintiffs in those cases.
In a case of a derivative claim, there is case law. I think it's ultimately discretionary, but there is case law that says the primary claim has to be pursued at the same time as the derivative claim. But
and if the primary claimant does not have a claim for damages, as everybody seems to concede here,
then she's,
why then what claim is being pursued on her behalf? Is it just a zero damages claim of a statutory violation, or why? I don't understand why.
Because we don't want attorneys 10 years later to come in and pursue a case on behalf of the child without the mother being a party.
Well, she could be a potential witness in the case. The defendant could certainly call her as a witness to have her testify about what she was and was not informed about if she's not a party, correct?
Correct.
Why do we need her to be a party?
It goes back to the fact that under the statute, our interpretation is that they're enforcing the right of the mother. If they're enforcing the right of the mother, she needs to be a party to it.
And I've got one final question, Chief May. I know your time is up, but counsel, I just want to make sure I understand. You are arguing that Charlie is not a patient. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. I think that's the best interpretation of the statute.
All right. So then I guess my question to you is, how do you reconcile that with what was argued in your brief? In which you indicate that Dr. Batley, quote, cannot discern the legislature's intent as to whether an unborn minor child is or should be a patient within the meaning of statute 44830. So he assumes that Charlie was his patient. How do you reconcile that from your briefing?
Justice, the follow-on to that is that it doesn't really matter, because if she was a patient, then there's statutory reasons why there's no duty owed. But I think I learned a little bit more, and I thought about it a little more, and I really thought about what the ACOG ethics opinion was, which is that the mother is the patient, and that the child is, of course, has
so you moved off your position a little bit between the briefing and the argument. Okay, I got you.
I guess it happens in this case. Okay.
Justice
Agadorn,
do you have a question?
Yeah, I was actually going to follow up on that too, because your brief said we can assume that, and to provide a response to the certified question, that the legislature intended that an unborn child is patient under 44830. So your position in your brief seem to be, yeah, there's some maybe arguments both ways, but we're going to assume that they do meet the definition of patient. But then you said in your brief that some of the exceptions are met, and therefore there was no duty. But the problem with that is that the exceptions under 44830 don't say exceptions to who's a patient. It just changes the way that the physician exercises their duty, right? I mean, the physician's duty to inform the patient under this section does not require disclosure of, and then it lists various things. So if you have a patient who would not understand or incapable of consenting, that doesn't make them not a patient under the statute. It just changes the nature of the duty of the doctor with regard to informed consent. Would you agree with that?
I think that it doesn't matter. It's a bit of semantics on whether you treat the baby as not a patient or if you remove the baby via the exceptions. I would have to, Justice, I'd have to look at the statute again in reference to when the exceptions reference patient. But to the overall interpretation of the statute is that it creates duties to inform the patient, and yeah, you can't have a duty to inform a fetus.
Well, the problem, I don't want to go too far down this, but I mean, for example, you argue that sub six applies information in cases where the patient, so we have to be talking about some patient already, is incapable of consenting. So, and therefore you say that Charlie did not have any informed consent rights because Charlie meets this definition. But the two problems with that, it seems, and I'll give you a chance to respond, is number one, it still means the unborn child is a patient in order for that exception to even apply. And secondly, it applies to all minors. For example, as Justice Rebecca Bradley pointed out, it would apply to a three-month-old child, no less than a child who's 8 months gestation.
Justice, I was responding to the position that the plaintiffs were taking in their brief, which was that it is an independent right held by the baby and includes, under the causation question, which is an objective question, a reasonable baby standard. So that's what I was addressing.
Under your reading of 44830, when does an individual become a patient?
Well, again, the standards of care for an obstetrician.
No.
Include
under right. 44830.
Yeah.
Under the statute.
I just want to assure everyone that there's of course professional and ethical obligations
to
baby, and that they do their best to meet that by working with the mother. But under the statute, our interpretation would be that the baby becomes a patient when it's born.
Counsel, I'm really curious about how you interpret sub six of the statute, which is the information in cases where the patient is incapable of consenting. And I'll just say that I think that applies when the patient themselves is incapable of consenting and there is no guardian or other third person who is exercising consent on their behalf. So if it's a minor child, the parent is typically the one exercising that consent. So the child isn't incapable in that sense and because they have a guardian capable of doing it. If it's an incompetent adult and there's a guardian present, that's the person from whom the doctor has to get consent. If there is an incompetent adult with no guardian and no, you know, power of attorney for healthcare or somebody to consult, then the doctor has no obligation to obtain informed consent. You agree with all that so far?
It's a reasonable interpretation.
All right. So here we have an unborn child and a parent or the person who is carrying that child, not a parent in the traditional sense. So isn't it kind of the simplest approach here to say that the person from whom the doctor has to get consent is the woman carrying the child? Do we have to reach this issue about whether the baby is or is not a patient when all roads lead to the woman carrying the baby here as the person from whom the doctor has to obtain informed consent? Do we need to reach the question?
I don't think we do. I would say first and foremost, because of the forfeiture and the mootness questions that are discussed in our brief, but we are conceding that the baby has a right to enforce the mother's.
Right, but you're saying that the pregnant woman, formerly pregnant woman, has to be named as a plaintiff for her to assert that claim, right?
Correct.
And she wasn't. So that's where you're saying the circuit court got it right in dismissing that claim because Samantha needed to be part of this case in order for Charlie to assert the claim of an injury arising from the lack of informed consent.
Correct. That's what the trial court ruled. That's what, and the plaintiffs sought to appeal to the Court of Appeals asking for permission to name the mother as a party. But they never sought that permission in the trial court.
Okay. And that's, I think that's kind of how I see it too. And that's why I was asking you the questions about why it is that Samantha needs to be named as a plaintiff when she's not the one claiming damages, which you've answered those. I'm not asking you to answer them again.
But the trial court's decision was premised on the notion that the unborn child is not a patient. The circuit court believed that the mother was the patient. That's it. I also note that the trial court said in its final ruling that four gentlemen shouldn't be deciding female rights with respect to their child in their body, but that's not what this case is about.
Yeah, that left the room a little cold. When he, But Your Honor, I don't think that he actually ruled on the basis of patient. I don't think he said that the baby, I don't think he got to that, but I may be wrong. What he got to was that the duty is owed to the mother and the mother needs to bring the claim.
He actually said under section 448.30, quote, I think the patient is the mother. Therefore, the informed consent would need to be given, I think he meant obtained, from the mother and no one else, and that the claim would have to be brought through the mother. And then he went on to if she had died. But it was premised on the notion that only the mother was the patient, not the child.
Right. I stand corrected.
Any other questions? Thank you. Mr. Tennyson?
I would like to just touch briefly on one topic, and that is whether or not the birth mother was an indispensable party. If we look at Wisconsin Statute 803.03, joinder of persons needed for a just and complete adjudication, what it says is, for the purposes of this section, a person's right to recover for loss of consortium shall be deemed a derivative right. Other court decisions, Phelps versus Physicians Insurance Company, Pierce versus Physicians Insurance Company, both stand for the proposition that injuries suffered directly by the patient, here that would be Charlie, are not derivative but are independent. So although the discussion has to be had with the birth mother, the duty runs to the patient, here Charlie May Brecky, and she has an independent right to bring that claim for damages through her parent or legal guardian. That's all I have to say, unless anyone has questions.
Anyone have any questions? Okay, thank you for answering all of our questions. Normally we take a longer recess. I'm gonna ask my colleagues to make as quick a turnaround as we can. We've got a couple people have tight deadlines. So if we could flip the courtroom around as quick as possible too, that would be great.
Thank you very much.
You want this?